This talk was given by Michael Yukon Grody at the Zen Center of New York City. Yukon is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
My name is Yukon. I'm a monastic from up at the Zen Mountain Monastery. And every now and then, the monks come down. We all take turns coming down to the temple and being down here for the week. I came down on Friday because of all the festivities and the Rahatsu going on up at the monastery. But it's really, it's so much fun to come down again and see all my old friends, all my noble friends. Welcome to the new year. Last month, it was the 50th anniversary of Thomas Merton's death. And for those of you who don't know who he was a Trappist monk. He was a prolific writer. He was a peace activist. He was a practitioner of Zen Buddhist meditation. He was really, he was a mystic. You know, he was a mystic, this guy. He was amazing, really. You know, the definition of a mystic is a person, by contemplation and self-surrender to obtain unity with or absorption into the absolute, or who believes in the spiritual resonance of truths that are beyond the intellect. You know, we so often use the phrase before a talk is given by the abbot at the monastery. We say that these talks are they're being offered as dark to the mind and radiant to the heart. You know, it's not apparent to the senses, not obvious to the intellect. Because, you know, we travel with so much stuff up here and so often need to compartmentalize everything, you know, to make it feel safe. I talk a lot about monastic life in this particular piece. But, you know, and it's our pursuit of renunciation, but anyone who enters a place like this, is walking into the door, of here or at the monastery, you know, we're all inclined in the same way. You're seeking refuge, actually, and you're yearning for clarity in your own life. It might not be that blatant, but that's what we're all doing. So this talk, though couched in a lot of monastic values, is offered to you as lay practitioners with the same depth of spirit, you know. Because look at 99% of Zen, any spiritual practitioners now are living their life in the world, are lay practitioners. We better make this relate to you. Because there aren't many people that want to be monks, you know. So we better start connecting right here. So this offering is meant to feel that kind of inclusivity, and so that being said, this is from Thomas Merton on his 50th anniversary of his passing. Monastic life is not quantitative. What counts is not the amount of activity and compassionate works, not the multitude and variety of ascetic practices, not the ascent of various degrees of holiness. What counts is not to count and not to be counted. This concept is very counter to the way that we live in the world. And it's like, huh? What is this? That piece of his always touched me deeply. He goes on, the apparent pointlessness of the monastery in the eyes of the world is exactly what gives it a real reason for existing. In a world of noise, confusion, and conflict, it is necessary that there be places of silence, inner discipline and peace. Not the peace of mere relaxation, but the peace of inner clarity and love. In a world of tension and breakdown, and this was written in the 60s, It is necessary for there to be people who seek to integrate their inner lives, not by avoiding anguish and running away from problems, but by facing them in their naked reality and in their ordinariness. Let no one justify the monastery as a place from which anguish is utterly absent and in which people have no problems. I mean, if anybody's been around our monastery for the last years, you'll know that there are plenty of problems. You know, the human experiment is all about problems and conflict and how to find our way back, you know. So, you know, as he says here, this is a myth. Well, it's not so much of a myth now. Closely related other myths that religion itself disposes of people's anxieties. I mean, ha. Faith itself implies a certain anguish. And it is a way of confronting inner suffering. It is not a magic formula for making all problems vanish. You know, people come up to me sometimes and they'll say, oh, you know, they're visiting for the first time and they say, oh, you guys sit around a lot, right? You sit around on your cushions and you're just sitting there and we're doing all the real work out here. What's going on? You know, and it's like, you have one perspective. That's one way of seeing what we do. Yeah, we do sit a lot, but there's something else that's going on here. We study the mind. You know, an unexamined mind is one dangerous thing which we see around us all the time. It's not easy. Our conditioning is so enmeshed and so powerful. You know, I've been doing this 35 years. And every morning when I sit down, I begin again. I'm beginning again, you know, to get what we want, to accomplish things. The ego-led drive to be somebody. In a land that even commodifies even the breath, you know, living in a culture that is so based in the material world that it may seem like a stretch to find resonance in a spiritual practice. When you walk into the temple or the monastery, you are giving yourself an opportunity to shake off a bit of the world, to touch another place in your being. And those of you who come here, you know that. You know, there are, I think, 10, 12 new folks here. Welcome. But you've come here, and it's no small thing to walk through these doors on a Sunday. You know, you have the right and the responsibility to connect with your not-so-obvious inheritance. Did something wacky go on here? Okay. Sitting in the Zendo in the middle of Brooklyn, what is offered here is such a simple practice. But it doesn't mean it's easy. It's really challenging. You know, in this world, this accumulation, Zazen could be seen as pointless, kind of fundamentally useless activity. You know, you can't argue for it. You can't justify it or make it into something good. But it is a wake-up call to go beyond our ideas, our justifications, our perspectives, in the service of trying to make sense out of a reality that can never be fixed. It can never be fixed. You can't hold it. You can't own it. You can't manipulate it. You can't trade it in for something newer, a shinier. You cannot. It's there. You cannot find something easier to grasp. So what is this that we have been given, you know? What's going on here? And it seems that we have little understanding or relationship to what's going on here. You know, I'm old now, I'm 70, you know, and I went to school in Berkeley in the late 60s. I was in Berkeley. You know, I got a degree in psilocybin and my PhD was in LSD. You know, I mean, it was literally everywhere. It was everywhere. I'm still suffering those consequences. But it's, you know, monasteries have always been, and temples and spiritual places of practice have always been for people like like me, who I couldn't find my way in the world. I never felt grounded. I couldn't feel myself. And so when I got out of school, you know, I came back east to work in what were the beginnings of the hospice programs in the 80s. It was at a place called St. Vincent Hospital. And I thought that if I could touch in with people who are dying, that would make me feel, you know, more grounded. And I went through a lot of patients, and it was making me crazy. And I was sitting in the village. I lived in the village in a one bedroom for $250 a month. There, I was one of those people, and I was sitting on the front stoop, kind of looking, I guess, cross-eyed and crazy. And a guy comes up to me and he says, "Hey, what's wrong?" And I said, "Well, I don't know you, but thank you for asking." And I help people in hospice, and I'm not doing good, and I don't know what the hell to do. And he says, "Well, you know, my name is Teshu, and I'm a student up at a place called the Zen Art Center. And there's a teacher there named Daido Sensei." He says, "Why don't you check him out? Give it a try. Maybe he can help you." I said, "Okay, I've got nothing to lose, man. I got nothing to lose." So I go up the next weekend, and, you know, something happened, and you're never clear about how you enter changing your life, and everything goes upside down. You never know when that's going to happen, how that happens, what that is exactly. Sometimes we call it, you know, bodhicitta. But when I met Daido, and at the time, you know, he had a gap in his front teeth, and he was just this crazy Roshi, you know, smoking and swearing, and I thought, that's my kind of guy. And so I started going up, and it was in 84, and then I moved in 94. And I would go home for retreats and like get on my knees and go, "Please, Lord, don't make me want to become a monk in the morning. Please, please don't make me want to do this. It's just too damn hard." And this teacher is really intense. Daido was, you know, he's very loving, but he's extremely charismatic and extremely intense. But, you know, when things fall away, when I became his student, and then went home again and got down on my knees, I went, "Oh shit, it happened." You know, it's like, it's happened. I can't turn back. It's one of those things. It's like a calling, you know, where you just have to just keep going forward no matter what. And then when I finally moved in 94, when my feet touched the ground, I went, "My vow is that this is where I stop," because I had to stop. I had to stop somewhere. So, and it's kind of like that feeling of, you know, you take off your backpack and you're kind of relieved from choice, you know, and there's something very powerful in that. Anyway, I digress big time. Sorry, my story. But I had to begin with by saying what I needed to find, what is the stillness that people are talking about? What is that, you know? And then attend to quieting the mind within that stillness, you know, feeling that stillness hold me. And then that gave me a chance to a question, to find a question, which it could help direct me not to an answer, because there are none, but to an experience, you know, an energy, an awareness. A clarity that gave me an opportunity to find more of who I what I was, what this is, what this human life is, you know. You know, at the monastery, we chant the Heart Sutra every single day. It's at the core, it's at the essence of the Mahayana teaching. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Avalokiteshvara being the bodhisattva who hears the cries of the world, the bodhisattva of compassion, she who hears the cries of the world. And doing deep prajna paramita, doing deep wisdom, you know, you're inhabiting that wisdom, clearly saw emptiness of all the five conditions. So no sensation, no conception, no discrimination, no awareness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no phenomenon, no realm of sight, no realm of consciousness. All that we have taken for granted is taken away. All in that Heart Sutra that we chant every single day. It's all taken away. So what's left? This path to walk. To begin to comprehend what we find we are in the midst of. What are we in the midst of here? In this practice, we have these skillful means to direct us toward who we really are. At least that's the way we feel it. The Four Noble Truths, the Eight Gates of Practice, all directing us to the reality of impermanence. How that reality touches us in our lives every single moment, whether we realize it or not. That there is not a single thing that is intrinsic and abiding anywhere to be found. You know, Lee Young Lee, he's a great poet. If you don't know him, check him out. He's amazing. He said it in this way. How do we learn to love that which is not for our keeping? How do we learn to love that which is not for our keeping? That I see as the gift, not the curse, you know, simply because you're touching the truth of all of this. Here's Merton again. Compassion seeks no justification outside itself. Compassion is sufficient to itself, is pleasing in itself, and for its own sake. Compassion is its own merit and its own reward. Compassion seeks no cause outside itself and no results other than itself. Are you okay in the front? Your knees hurting? Go grab a chair. You okay? You're killing me, yeah. You all right? Speaking of compassion, are you all right? Okay, you comfortable? Okay. So it's just my talk. It's giving you that. Okay. The fruit of compassion is compassion. And the reason for this all-sufficient character of compassion is that it comes from one's own realization of wisdom as one's source. It returns to oneself as its end because wisdom itself is compassion. To realize this, you don't have to be a monk, you know, but you do need to practice. You know, and you need to sit yourself down again on that damn cushion. You know, once again, over and over again, and deal with that monkey mind, that blah, 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 all the justifications and ways in which we see the world. The heart of this compassion is based on a keen awareness of the interdependence of every single thing that arises. Total connection, total relationship. One could say that love seeks one thing, the good of the one loved. In this way, love is its own reward. When one does good, when it's authentic, you're not doing good to make yourself feel better or superior or for merit. You do it to simply do good, period. You know, when you sit in Zazen, you sit just to sit. Because within that activity is the nature of the way things are. A fish swims, a bird flies, those devoted to Zazen sit. You know, we don't believe it, but we have what we seek already present. We were born with it, but we just don't buy it. It is there all the time, and if we give it time, it will make itself known to us. But it's a lot. It's not a practice for a sprinter. Like Dido said, it's for a long distance runner. We sit so that we can be truly still and see what's difficult to see. We are so obsessed with doing that we have no time and not much imagination left for being. Just to be. Just to be. You know. a subtle way of reminding people what's been forgotten, just to be. So coming here is a choice, to practice is a choice, to enable us to fulfill the deepest capacities of our real selves is a choice. But this opportunity is not given to everybody, you know, depending upon our karma, what we are born into, what we have available to us in our daily existence. Our circumstances are so varied, you know. And our suffering is so multidimensional. It can be so blatant and it can be so subtle. You know, there's the suffering of suffering. The more conventional experiences, you know, of aging, sickness, death. I got up out of bed today and something felt funny. And I went, what the hell is that? I didn't even do anything. I go, oh yeah, I'm just getting old. That's what that is. You know, you don't have to do anything anymore to go, ouch. You just go, ouch. And I was, oh, what's that? Oh yeah, it's being 70. There is the suffering of change, which is constant, whether we know it or not, or like it or not. We can count on it for sure. By the very nature, feelings are fleeting, and so often define ourselves by our moods and our thoughts, you know. We don't let ourselves be happy or sad. You know, we become a happy person or a sad person. You know, a tendency of making things out of that which is no thing. Making things out of that which is no thing. And there's the suffering of conditioning, you know, of habits that run deep and take a real determination to turn around. You know, it takes a real heart. The truth that in arising there is passing for each and everything, to understand that clearly doesn't mean that it still can't break our heart. You know, but it's this broken heart that becomes more tender, become more tenderized, you know, that become the vulnerability allows us to become more attentive to what we have in front of us, to care. As close to the moment to moment as a person can get, you know, it's good medicine. You know, we touch upon dignity, surround ourselves with noble friends, you know. The constant noise of the world, the constant flow of words, images, sounds, means that we make a greater effort than ever before to touch into an interior silence, you know. Letting go of our preoccupations, our habitual thoughts, and start to listen to a more quiet voice. Only in silence can we begin to connect with reality. This is what has been handed down for centuries now. There are lots of ways to meditate, but you know, Zen is really known as the meditation school of Buddhism. So the foundation of this practice, it's kind of like a new kind of listening, you could call it. To listen to what's quiet as opposed to active. When you're upset, agitated, confused, depressed, there's still the ability to listen to another kind of like a softer voice. There is a presence, you know, sometimes open, maybe feels expansive. There is an ancient, ancient grounding, a timeless kind of presence. There is so much we take for granted and it's not considered worth spending our time on, so much unappreciated. It takes just a second to distract us from what we call being bored. You know, losing our focus so we can then be entertained away from something much quieter, much more profound. Something that can be so simple is so often overlooked. Paying attention to what is often overlooked is a way of connecting with the heart. The gift of this moment-to-moment consciousness is one of the many overlooked gifts we have been given as human beings. You know, it is said that silence itself is a human value. Restraint from useless words has a human value. That's why I keep these talks short. Listen fully requires silence. There's a philosopher, a Swiss philosopher, Max Picard. He talks of speech and silence belonging together. He says, speech without silence is like seeing Shakespeare's fools without the solidity of Shakespeare's heroes. I love that. You know, in the Rule of Benedict, it specifically warns against the most breathless kinds of talk. I love that. Breathless kinds of talk. Murmuring, gossip, grumbling. I love these synonyms. They're like hearsay, chit-chat, scuttlebutt. And the people I come from would call it kvetching, right? A lot of kvetching. Often when I'm kvetching, I think that that's going to make me feel better, but it doesn't. And then I need to take a long shower to wipe off the grunge from the whining, you know? The soak off the grime of the wine, the grime of the wine. When living in a community, silence also has its practical aspects, you know? The doors are wide open here. People will enter here for a million different reasons. We are so diverse, all this chit-chat and whatnot can be destructive in any small community, much less a monastery built to exemplify our attempt of finding the best that we have in ourselves, you know. You know, in the olden days, monasteries were these closed communities, you know, and they had lawyers and farmers and soldiers and schoolboys all living together and going everywhere together and working together, chanting in the choir together and sitting in the same place together. When they read or study, you know, it was a good thing they didn't talk. You know, that's a lot of being together. You know, at the monastery now, we've instituted in the evening, we have our meal. And then when the meal comes close to closing, the bell goes off and we go into silence. And then we're silent for the rest of the evening through the morning up until after service when we go down for breakfast. There's a real healing in that, you know, you get quiet. Because you know that all this talk, you know, it's exhausting. And then you just start talking stupid stuff after a while. It just gets stupid. You know, and to get quiet again with people can be really, really beautiful. So in this new year, can we learn more about letting this quiet meet us and teach us about the reality that we've been given and new ways to meet each other with a kind of quiet spaciousness, you know. The most intimate aspects of our own being, you know, these talks are generally reminders. People give these talks, we're just reminding ourselves, you know. I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to me. I better get this shit together. You know, it's like, and this is an offering in relationship to that, you know. It's like we're talking to ourselves here. And then hopefully it's an offering to you, you know. But it's about how resilient the heart really can be. Because this life is not easy. We go up and we go down. But in the midst of all of this, to develop more of a relationship with what is simple and quiet. You know, Max Picard, once again, he wrote that silence stands outside the world of profit and utility. Yeah. It cannot be exploited. You cannot get anything out of it. Silence does increase in time, silence does increase in time, but time increases in silence. It's as though time has been sown into silence, as though silence has been absorbed, as though silence were the soil in which time grows to its fullness.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JIZOPROJECT.